In the last couple of weeks, we looked at the various Hindu texts that are kind of the foundational texts for most Hindu traditions. As I mentioned, there's one group of texts we haven't talked about yet, which are the tantric texts, which we'll look at next term when we look at traditions that build on these tantric texts. But the texts we've so far talked about, they're in a sense kind of the major texts that a variety of traditions are building on in terms of for their theology, but also for their ritual practices. And there's a lot of texts that we will see in next term when we look at Hinduism too, and we look at the individual traditions that are developing. But these texts will be very sort of specific to one particular tradition. And so you have a lot of texts that that are just important for a specific tradition that other traditions don't engage with. Often they're texts that are produced from within that particular tradition. So those we'll look at later. But basically the main texts we've looked at in the last 7 weeks. What I want to do today is begin to look at the way traditions start to engage with these texts. We'll particularly look at what is called the darshanas, which literally means seeing. It's a term that's also used for when you go to the temple, you have darshan of the deity in the temple. You see the deity that's worshipped in the temple, and the deity sees you. But it's used also to refer to what is often translated as philosophical schools. There's some difficulties with that notion of them being philosophies. In the West, we kind of have developed this distinction between philosophy and theology, which is not there in the Indian context. So think of them as philosophical or theological schools or schools of thought, or however you want to characterize them. But they're different schools that emerge fairly early on. The earliest kind of go back to a few centuries BC, you'll often find references to six darshanas, and it's kind of a number that's fairly old that kind of you find in various texts. Exactly which are the six darshanas is more complicated, and that changes over time. The way you'll most often find it these days, and kind of for the last 1,000 years or so, is the six darshanas being these: Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Sankhya, and Yoga, and Mimamsa and Vedanta. I'll say a bit more about them and then look at two in greater detail, just these two today. As I said, this is kind of the classification you find for at least 1,000 years or so. If you open any book on Indian philosophy or Hinduism, you'll find reference to the six darshanas being these six. And you'll often find in this context the distinction that we talked about before of Astika versus Nastika schools, where the Astika schools are those who say Asti, there is, and those who accept the authority of the Veda, and the Nastika schools being schools that reject the authority of the Veda, like Buddhism and Jainism and others. You'll find said that these six are the Astika schools, and the Nastika schools are those who were not, quote unquote, Hindu, who don't accept the authority of the Veda. In the earliest classifications of the darshanas, that distinction isn't quite there. Vedanta, for example, is a fairly late addition to the list. and yoga as well. And you'll find often in earlier authors who talk about the six darshanas will include Buddhism and Jainism as well as one of the darshanas. And it's just kind of these are the six systems of thought that are, you know, common in those days. There's another school of thought that's a little more controversial, and that is the Lokayata, or as they're often called, the Charvakas, named after the sage who's supposed to have, or the teacher who's supposed to have taught this Charvaka. And the Lokayatas are sometimes classified as a darshana, but by and large, authors will say, yeah, that's not really a darshana, because the Lokayatas, they're the materialists. And they argue, essentially, that there is nothing except that which you perceive with your sensory faculties. Consciousness is a product of matter, and when matter combines, then consciousness arises, and there is no heaven, there is no afterlife, this is all you get here. And so the motto is, Charvakas is said to have said, eat as much ghee as you can, ghee is a clarified butter, and enjoy. And it's a school that there's only one text of this that has survived, the Tattva Plavasimha, the lion that devours all truth or all categories. But we find a lot of references to them in refutations of others, in authors of other schools who refute them. So a lot of Buddhist and Jain and Hindu authors and authors of these various schools refute their views. And kind of saying, you know, this is not how you should think about things. And so, as I mentioned, some authors kind of see this as a sort of one of the six darshanas, and the sort of the classification sort of shifts then a little bit. But a lot of authors will say, well, this is not really a proper darshana because they have no conception of the self, they have no conception of an afterlife, they have no conception of anything beyond their senses, and therefore we cannot take this seriously. Some scholars have, like for example, Wendy Doniger recently, has questioned whether there actually was a school of Lokayatas, or whether this was just sort of a way of voicing critique against Brahmins, because one of the sort of the focus of the Lokayatas is making fun of the Brahmins who tell everyone that there is an afterlife, and therefore they need you, they need the Brahmins to perform rituals, and so. They need to pay the Brahmins, and so the Brahmins, in order to fill their bellies, as they often say, the Lokayatas, they just tell people, they make everything up, and they say, oh, just, you know, you should perform these rituals, you should do this, and just pay us so you can go to heaven. And so some have argued that that this might have been just sort of a way of sort of voicing critique against Brahmin Brahmins and the power that Brahmins had. But there are, as I mentioned, there is at least one text that has survived in fragments only, but the earlier authors do take it as a sort of a serious school that they have to refute, but not serious enough to include it in the darshanas in all cases. Now, if we work with these six that you have here, as they're sort of classified as astikas, so they're classified as schools that accept the authority of the Veda, and all of them do. But the way the importance of that varies considerably from schools to school. Some schools, like the last two here, Mimamsa and Vedanta, are entirely concerned with the interpretation of the Vedic texts. The Mimamsas with the four Vedas themselves and the Vedanta with the Upanishads. And so their entire thought, their entire theology is built on the interpretation of these texts and is concerned with making sense of what these texts are saying. The other four schools, the engagement with Vedic texts is much less. The Sankhya school that you have there, the third one in the list, second one in the first column, is a school that at least in the literature that we have now of the school, doesn't engage all that much with the Vedic texts and or the Upanishads, but historically seems to have engaged quite extensively with the Upanishads, because in Vedanta texts, in early Vedanta texts, you find constant refutations of Sankhya interpretations of the Upanishads. And we'll look a bit more at Sankhya in a moment. But it seems to have emerged as a school that was concerned with the interpretation of the Upanishads. But then as it sort of developed, it sort of moved away slightly from the Upanishads. And it becomes more sort of a way of thinking about things more generally rather than specifically dealing with exegesis, which is something that Vedanta and Mimamsa continue to be. The yoga school that you have there barely engages with the Vedic texts. It claims the authority of the Vedic texts, like the later Sankhya texts do, but it doesn't really engage with them. It is not concerned with interpreting these texts or citing these texts in support of their views. Yoga, I should perhaps stress this, is not what is here, not what is commonly understood by yoga today. Yoga here is a meditational sort of school, is a school that's concerned with philosophy of mind and with the practice of meditation. And what is now called yoga in sort of the popular sense is really kind of a development out of tantric texts that we'll see more about next term, that sometimes sort of built on ideas from these, from the school of yoga, from the darshana of yoga, but often doesn't. Now, Nyaya and Vaisheshika are, again, claim in the beginning of their text the authority of the Veda, but really engage very little with these Vedic texts. Vaisheshika is sort of an attempt to understand the nature of matter and the nature of reality, which then helps to understand the nature of the self. And they make reference to Vedic texts, but it's not sort of the core of their of the school. Nyaya, on the other hand, is a school of essentially Vedic apologetics. At least that's how it starts. The early Nyaya authors claim that what they want to do is Nyaya basically means logic, or comes to mean logic, and it's a school of logic. And what they claim to want to do is establish certain ideas that are central to the Vedic text and Vedic ritual, not with reference to the authority of the Vedas, as Mimamsa and Vedanta would do, but rather merely through logic, through reasoning. That's kind of how Nyaya starts. And in early texts, you kind of find references to that, where they say that in order to accept the authority of the Veda, we need to kind of establish this on a rational sort of basis, because that will remove doubts as to what the Vedas are teaching. And if that removes doubt, then our knowledge, our understanding of the Vedic text will be firm, and that will help us to attain liberation. Later Nyaya texts kind of become sort of a little divorced from that sort of apologetic enterprise, and are mostly just concerned with the nature of logic itself and certain ideas. What Nyaya is mostly concerned with is the existence of God, and so you get arguments for the existence of God, the existence of the self, occasionally, though less so, the authority of the Veda. But that's kind of more of a side thing. But it's particularly those first two, the nature of the self, the existence of the self, and the existence of God. And so it's a very theistic school that engages or sort of takes on the Buddhist critiques of Hindu ideas, and is in constant debate with Buddhism in the beginning, and later on with some of the other schools, particularly Mimamsa and Vedanta, become important opponents for Nyaya. But all of these are really schools of thought, and they're really different, you know, although they're kind of classified as being Astikas, as being sort of, you know, all part of the Vedic tradition in the broadest sense. all of these argue with each other about the nature of reality. For those that are concerned with exegesis, the interpretation of Vedic texts, the nature of the self, the nature of consciousness. And so, for example, with Nyaya, even though they're a school of logic, it's not just that they're about logic, but there are certain ideas that are very essential to the Nyaya school that they teach. And so theism is one of them. They're very theistic. They always argue for the existence of God. They're also, however, and this is a something that pretty much every other school doesn't understand, is they also argue, they argue for liberation, but for example, they also argue that liberation is not a state of consciousness, because consciousness is a product of the interaction between the mind and the physical body. And so when you attain liberation, you lose the physical and the subtle body, and you exist in a state of liberation, but there's no consciousness, which, like the school of Vedanta often says, oh, so that means you become a stone. Why would we want that? And so there are certain ideas that are very essential to the school that they teach that differ from each other. Many of those, particularly Nyaya and Mimamsa, develop a very sophisticated philosophy of language. And a sort of an understanding of the way reasoning works as well. So a system of logic that's developed particularly by those two schools as well. What all of them have in common is that there is some emphasis on attaining a state that could be called liberation. And so all of these schools are involved in philosophizing and thinking about the world and thinking about the self in order to attain liberation. That's kind of the stated goal. Now you can pick up a text, a Nyaya text, for example, or a Mimamsa text from like the 12th century, and you'll find little reference to that because they're concerned with specific issues. But that's kind of the understanding of the broader project, as it were, at least in the beginning. Now, I've kind of classified them here sort of in pairs of two, and that's because they kind of work together in a sense. Nyaya, as I mentioned, is a school of logic and is concerned with at least initially with defending the Vedic ideas and then later with proving the existence of God and proving the existence of the self. And it is often coupled with Vaisheshika. And Vaisheshika is a school that's in some ways similar to Nyaya, and at some point kind of gets absorbed almost into the school of Nyaya, where you get texts written by certain authors where it's hard to tell whether this is a Nyaya or a Vaisheshika text, and various authors will look at that in both ways. But Vaisheshika is a school that's concerned with the understanding of reality in the biggest sense, but particularly of matter. And they spend a lot of time analyzing the nature of matter as a way of then helping you to understand the difference of the self and consciousness from matter. They're most famous for a theory of something you could call atomism, where they argue that matter constitutes of atoms, of sort of small indivisible particles that combine together to form the nature of sort of matter as we know it from our experience. The principal teacher of Vaisheshika is called Karnada, which means he who eats atoms. And it's probably not his real name, but sort of or Karnabhuj, as he's often called, literally he who eats atoms. So that's kind of how he's referred to within the school itself. It's probably a name that was sort of given to him by others. It's a school that that wasn't as popular as the other ones. It's a school, as I mentioned, that kind of gets absorbed into Nyaya and loses its sort of own identity for a while. And it's the least popular of all of them. But it's kind of closely linked with these. Sankhya and Yoga, again, are also closely linked, and I'll say a bit more about Sankhya in a moment, but it's basically the way These two schools operate with similar terminology and a similar metaphysics that they kind of look at from two different perspectives. These are perhaps, of all the schools, these are perhaps the oldest ones, at least having the oldest they might not be the oldest in the sense that we know them now, but sort of their antecedents go back the furthest. The Mahabharata talks extensively about Sankhya and Yoga, and really the metaphysics of the Mahabharata is really a Sankhya metaphysics that it kind of then builds on. It's not quite the same as what you find in the later Sankhya schools, what you find in the Mahabharata, but it's clearly kind of part of the same development. The main difference between the two is, and this is already kind of highlighted in the Mahabharata itself, is that Sankhya is atheistic, whereas Yoga is a theistic school. Which is why, the argument that astika means, that what they say asti there is God, as you often find in contemporary books, is kind of problematic, because Sankhya is really an atheistic school. They do not believe in the existence of the supreme deity, but rather, as we'll see, in a sense, they're a dualistic school that argue for the sort of an equal status almost of consciousness and matter that then interacts to sort of create what we experience in our everyday life. Whereas yoga, which is a system of meditation, is really a theistic school, not in the sense that sort of God is sort of all over the place in these texts and is central to it, but there are a lot of references to God in yoga texts. Though in its understanding of liberation, there is no reference actually to God whatsoever. So it talks about God, it talks about devotion to God as being an alternative system to the system of meditation that it teaches. But then when it talks about liberation, there's no mention of God whatsoever. So it's a bit unclear exactly why that is. Some have argued that this is because yoga is attempting to be very non-sectarian, and so sort of allowing other traditions to kind of fill in the blanks of its system. But anyway, that's sort of nature of that. Mimamsa and Vedanta, these are perhaps the most influential schools of all of the six. And as I mentioned, these are really exegetical schools. They're concerned with the interpretation of the Vedic text. And the Mimamsa is concerned with karma, with the interpretation of Vedic ritual, whereas Vedanta, building on the Upanishads, is concerned with jnana, with knowledge, and Brahman, whereas this is concerned with karma. And really, they're sister schools in a sense, in the sense that the Vedanta schools will often claim that what they are is the Uttara Mimamsa, the further Mimamsa or the later Mimamsa, and you'll find often references to Mimamsa as being Purva Mimamsa, the earlier or the preliminary Mimamsa, which is a sort of an appellation the Mimamsakas really don't like, obviously. But it's kind of Vedanta is basically building on Mimamsa and taking its philosophy of language, its hermeneutics, and some of its metaphysics, and just applying that to an understanding, to a reading of the Upanishads, in order to come to an understanding of Brahman. The big difference between the two, and it's kind of the relationship between these two, as we'll see next term, is very contested amongst Vedanta schools, exactly what that means for Vedanta to be the Uttara Mimamsa, the later Mimamsa. How important is the study of Mimamsa for the study of Vedanta? That's something that the Vedanta theologians themselves will struggle with and kind of address and debate amongst themselves. the big sort of difference in a way between these two is that Mimamsa too is an atheistic school, and whereas Vedanta is theistic in some sense, in the sense that it has the idea of Brahman as being the cause of this world. Mimamsa argues against that. And if Samkhya is kind of an atheistic school in the sense that it doesn't deal with God and doesn't make room for God in its metaphysics, Mimamsa is sort of actively atheistic, at least early Mimamsa. And Mimamsakas will argue against the existence of a supreme deity who controls the world, who creates the world. And for them, the world is eternal. There is no cause to this world. To argue that there must be is for them, you know, they use logic to kind of prove that there cannot be a supreme being. Later Mimamsa, however, under the influence of Vedanta, and particularly under the influence of devotional traditions that emerged in the last 1,000 years, becomes theistic, actually. And so you get later Mimamsa authors who say, yes, there is a God, and so on, and just sort of tag that onto Mimamsa. But earlier Mimamsa and classical Mimamsa is fundamentally atheistic. Now, all of these schools have their own foundational texts, that the author, the sort of teachers of their school, will write commentaries on. And all of these texts are very concise, and they're what are called sutras. And we've seen the term sutras before in reference to the ritual manuals, like the Kshota Sutras and the Grisha Sutras and the Dharma Sutras, where they refer to sort of concise statements on a certain thing. What these texts are doing is kind of the foundational texts of these, they're also sutras, but they're sort of taking that conciseness one step further. The sort of the saying is that if you're writing a sutra, if you're writing sort of a sutra text, and you can shorten your particular sutra by one syllable, you experience the joy of having a son, which is kind of in Sanskrit literature the greatest joy you can attain in this world of having, you know, when your son is born. And so that's kind of how these texts are written. They're immensely concise, which means they're easy to memorize, and sort of they're easy to be used as sort of a sutra, literally a thread in teaching. But it also means that they're sometimes ambiguous exactly what they're saying. And so commentaries become immensely important for those texts. No one reads these sutras independently. Everyone starts reading these with certain commentaries on them. But this also leads to the development of distinct schools within these schools. And this is particularly so with Vedanta, where you get a whole range of schools that are all concerned with the interpretation of the Upanishads, and all concerned with the interpretation of the foundational text for Vedanta, the Vedanta Sutras or the Brahma Sutras. This is the same text. Basically, the sutras on the Vedanta, on the Upanishads, or the sutras on the Brahman. It's called by two names, but it's essentially the same text. You have different authors who are all commenting on the Brahma Sutras or the Vedanta Sutras, but coming up with very different ways of reading those texts and very different ways of reading the Upanishads as a result. And that leads to sort of different schools within it. The other traditions, the ones that have their own sort of develop into their own schools, Mimamsa also splits into two schools on issues of philosophy of language mostly, and the interpretation of the sort of certain ideas concerning ritual and the nature of the self. Nyaya kind of develops into different schools as well, though in a different way from the others, in that Nyaya in the 14th century, you get Nyayikas, authors of Nyaya, who start to rethink the whole of this whole sort of discipline, the whole school of Nyaya, and come up with what becomes called the Navya Nyaya, the new Nyaya, which is basically kind of rereading the earliest texts of Nyaya. And that becomes kind of the dominant way of thinking about Nyaya from the 14th century onwards, and kind of comes to almost supplant the old school of Nyaya. But here you have two very distinct schools. Here you have a whole range of schools. A number of those schools have their own sort of schisms within themselves. So there's kind of this sort of very rich sort of tapestry of thought, if you want, that you have there. Now, as I mentioned, each of these has their own foundational texts, and it's kind of convenient that the titles of these are fairly easy to remember. You have the Nyaya Sutras, the Vaisheshika Sutras, the Yoga Sutras, the Vedanta Sutras or the Brahma Sutras, the Mimamsa Sutras, and the Sankhya doesn't have sutras but has karikas, which are, this is Sankhya Karika. A karika is actually a verse rather than sort of a prose, a concise statement. But it's essentially, again, sort of a very concise text that then commentaries are written on. But all the others is just Nyaya Sutras, Vaisheshika Sutras, and so on. Let's see. Okay. Now, of all the schools here, Vedanta will be, a lot of what we'll talk about in Hinduism too will be Vedanta, because that becomes one of the dominant schools in sort of the last 2,000 years or so. Nyaya and Vaisheshika, as I mentioned, is not that prominent kind of becomes absorbed in this. Nyaya is influential, but it's mostly influential in kind of an academic sense, in that there is no, unlike, say, these last four schools, Nyaya is not really concerned with religious practice itself, and it's more kind of an academic discipline in sort of that helps you to understand things. And as I said, they do touch on metaphysics and so on, but there isn't really sort of a religious school of Nyaya, of people who sit down and practice Nyaya in some way. It's really kind of an intellectual discipline. And kind of in the last millennium or something or so, you find a lot of authors who really are authors of other schools who start to engage with Nyaya and write texts on Nyaya more as kind of an academic discipline of using Nyaya, often kind of modifying the metaphysics a little bit. And so it's kind of not really sort of the same as these other schools. Samkhya Yoga, Vedanta, and Mimamsa, on the other hand, these really shape the religious identity and religious practice and theologies of what we now know as Hinduism. And of these two, I want to particularly look at Samkhya and Mimamsa, partly because they're so different and they help you kind of understand the range of ideas you find there, but also because both of these are in some ways the foundation for the other two schools of Yoga and Vedanta, which build on Samkhya and Mimamsa respectively. And so kind of understanding these two will help you understand the other two. Sankhya is a school that, as I mentioned, is probably one of the oldest of all of them. There's constant references to Sankhya in the Mahabharata, which is really a Sankhya text, as well as in the Bhagavad Gita, which is, as we've seen, a part of the Mahabharata, which constantly refers to Sankhya ideas and uses the term Sankhya and Yoga throughout its text. But it's also some of the ideas that become important for Sankhya and Yoga go back to the Upanishads themselves. And some of the terminology that Sankhya and Yoga use is an Upanishadic terminology, but they tend to focus or they sort of build on terms that are used in Vedanta but not so important in Vedanta. And for example, whereas Vedanta will talk about the individual self as being the Atman, or the Jiva, or the Jivatman, the living being, or the self, Sankhya will always use the term Purusha, which is a term we've seen several times before in reference to the Purusha Sukta, the person who's sacrificed at the beginning of creation, from whose dismembered body parts comes the order of the world. But it's also a term, as we've seen, that is used in some of the theistic Upanishads to refer to what other Upanishads would call Brahman. Purusha literally means person, but is here understood in the sense that Atman is understood in Vedantic texts. So it's the individual self, the consciousness that is within the body. As I mentioned, Sankhya, in its classical form, does not engage extensively with the Upanishads, but the Brahma Sutras, for example, or the Vedanta Sutras, constantly refute Sankhya interpretations of the Upanishads, which kind of shows that there was a strong engagement with the Upanishads from Sankhya thinkers. But none of these works, all the earliest works of Sankhya, have not survived, apart from the Mahabharata. And so it's hard to sort of figure out exactly the origins of the tradition and how it started. But what is characteristic of Sankhya is its interest in a radical dualism and its interest then in enumeration. Sankhya itself means enumeration or counting. And it's a school that likes to kind of separate things into neat categories, much like Vaisheshika actually does as well. But for Sankhya, this is very central to its idea, because in order, what they argue you have to do is you have to come to realize the difference between the Purusha, the individual self, between consciousness and Prakriti. Matter, which is the sort of the world we perceive, including the body, the mind, and the intellect. And so this is kind of the fundamental dualism that underscores the Sankhya, and it's really a hard dualism, much more so than you find. I mean, kind of the distinction between matter and consciousness is something that pervades a lot of these schools. But what Sankhya argues is that these two are fundamentally distinct. Some Vedanta schools will argue that, you know, Prakriti emerges from Brahman. Brahman creates the world out of himself, and therefore Brahman is a transformation of the Purusha, of consciousness, there understood in sort of a theistic sense. Whereas Sankhya says, no, these two are eternally distinct, and there is no God. There is just a multiplicity, sort of a multitude of Purushas, of individual units of consciousness that inhabit their own bodies and experience the world in accordance, you know, through their sensory faculties. And the goal is to understand the difference between the two. The problem we now have in Sankhya terms is that we as consciousness identify with matter. We think we are the body. And we identify with the joys and the sufferings and the sorrows that come with the body. And so understanding the difference between the two will lead us to a state of liberation, which they call Kaivalya, which is the abstraction of Kevala, which means alone. And so it's a state of aloneness in the sense that in the state of liberation, in the state of Kaivalya, the Purusha, the consciousness, is alone or is separated from Prakriti and exists on its own. In Sankhya terms, Kaivalya or liberation is a state of consciousness, unlike what Nyaya authors argue. But it's a state where you just have individual units of consciousness who exist in a state of pure consciousness, which is a state of bliss. And that's all sort of Sankhya really says about this. It doesn't really get into the nature of the state of liberation in great detail, but its focus is rather on how to attain the state of liberation. Now, what Sankhya argues is that the world that we perceive has come about due to the contact of Purusha with Prakriti, of consciousness with matter. And they argue there is no creator to this world, but this world emerges when consciousness and matter come together. What Sankhya argues is that the consciousness is inactive, but or Purusha is inactive but conscious, whereas Prakriti is active but unconscious. Purusha, the individual self, is inactive in the sense that it has no agency. But when Purusha kind of comes in contact with Prakriti, then Prakriti, as it were, gets activated and starts to evolve in the ways that we now see the world. So in a sense, what Sankhya argues is that the foundation of this world, the origin of this world, is what they call pradhana or primordial matter, which is from which this world is created, which is an idea that the Vedanta authors constantly refute, where they say, no, the source of this world is Brahman, and the Sankhya say, no, the source of this world is matter itself, is a primordial state of matter which is undifferentiated. But then when consciousness comes in contact with it, somehow it starts to become differentiated and leads to the different categories of reality as we experience it now. The analogy that's sometimes given is just as you have pieces of iron and a magnet, where the magnet, when it comes in contact with the pieces of iron, kind of can make the pieces of iron move. And so in the same way, the magnet is the Purusha, which exerts its influence over Prakriti and gets Prakriti to move. But what this means is that for Sankhya is that in our daily life, we identify with the actions that we perform, but that is a state of ignorance, and we have to come to realize that we are inactive, and we are just the seer, the observer, the witness of Prakriti, which is the seeing. And once we come to understand this and come to realize this and experience the world through that, we can then attain the state of liberation. Sankhya argues that Prakriti, although it's the source of suffering, is not inherently, is not sort of an evil thing in any way. Rather, it says that this is just sort of a neutral thing in a way. There's a verse in the Sankhya Karikas that says that Prakriti is like a dancer on the stage, and she performs her dance because Prakriti is feminine and Purusha is male. That's kind of the symbolism that's in there as well. Prakriti performs her dance on the stage, and once the Purusha kind of realizes its separateness from Prakriti, then the dancer kind of takes a bow, leaves the stage, and the Purusha attains liberation. And so there's nothing sort of evil about Prakriti, but it's about what is to be rejected as kind of the identification of Purusha with Prakriti. Yoga is a school that builds on this and basically adds God to this, and sort of you have a supreme Purusha who's sort of beyond all the other Purushas, but is primarily concerned with the practice of meditation and witnessing the fluctuations of the mind and practicing control of breathing and the practice of asanas, which sort of yoga postures, which in the older yoga school is purely sort of seated postures. It's basically you train yourself to be able to sit for an extended period of time so you can absorb yourself in meditation, which then leads to various degrees of sort of meditative absorption and then leads to a state of Kaivalya. Yoga too has very little to say about Kaivalya, as I mentioned, about the state of liberation. And you'll find often kind of said that sort of yoga is kind of the practice and Sankhya is sort of the theory, which kind of makes sense if you think of it from a yoga perspective, but this, from the Sankhyas themselves, they have their own practices of sort of meditational practice. It's not as developed as the yoga practices in their literature, but they do kind of, they were a distinct school. And you still actually have in Orissa, there's an ashram that's sort of purely Sankhya, and they just follow Sankhya, and that's kind of it. But it's a school that really ceases to be influential in the last 2,000 years or so. Um, and particularly the last 1,000 years. There's some important authors earlier on, but it never kind of attained to the same sort of status as, for example, Mimamsa and Vedanta or Nyaya. Okay, very briefly, Mimamsa. Mimamsa, as I mentioned, is a school that's concerned with the interpretation of the Vedic texts, and particularly of Vedic ritual. And it's really a school that develops a very complex ritual theology. For Mimamsa, everything has to do with ritual, and they interpret everything in terms of ritual. They argue that the goal of life is to inquire about the nature of dharma, which for them, dharma, they argue, is that which is taught by injunctions, by the Vedic injunctions. When the Veda says, do this ritual, do this, don't do that, that is how we come to know what dharma is. And it then kind of develops a whole theology about the around this the practice of Vedic ritual. And develops a very complex philosophy of language in order to help with their hermeneutics, develops a fairly complex sort of theory of action itself and how we perform actions, sort of intention and so on, how that all comes to play into our performance of action. But really, it's kind of a school that is very influential. But again, this seems to have been fairly academic in a sense, because a lot of the ideas that Mimamsa teaches are ideas that I think a lot of Vedic ritualists would have a hard time taking seriously. And that is because they start with certain assumptions and really push those assumptions as far back as they can. And for example, the Mimamsakas argue that, well, as we've seen, they argue against the existence of a supreme deity. But they also argue that really Vedic ritual is not about the Vedic gods. And they say the Vedic gods are an element of sacrifice, but they're really not that important to sacrifice. And they say the gods are essentially on the same level as the wood and the ghee and so on that is used in the ritual, in the sense that when you perform a ritual, you need an object to whom, someone for whom you can make the offering, just as you need the wood to kindle the fire. But just as the sacrifice is not about the wood, so the sacrifice is not about Indra or Soma or Varuna or any of the Vedic gods that are worshipped. And it's about the action in itself. It's the power is of Vedic ritual is in the ritual itself, and it's the ritual itself that forces the gods to reciprocate with their sort of rewards. But the Mimamsa authors go one step further, and that is that at some point, and this is not sort of their starting point, this is kind of, they come to that after a sort of, long explanations on various things. For example, there's one commentator on the Mimamsa Sutras called Shabara, who's sort of the oldest commentator that's still widely read. And at some point, he's kind of arguing with an opponent about the nature of the gods. And essentially what he comes to is he says that whether the gods actually exist out there or not, he says, is entirely irrelevant. He says the only thing we have to assume is that the gods exist in the utterance that we make during the ritual. So if I say, Idam Indraya Namama, this is for Indra, not for me, as you say when you make an offering to Indra. We have to assume that the word Indraya, for Indra, has a significance within the sentence that we utter there. But whether there actually is a god, Indra, who exists outside of that utterance is entirely irrelevant. And he says, we cannot know, and it's not important. And so it's kind of, if you read, Harry Potter or something, you have to assume when you're reading Harry Potter that Harry Potter, the character, kind of exists within the narrative and has sort of significance in the narrative, but whether there really is a Harry Potter or not is entirely irrelevant in a sense. So that's kind of what they're arguing with the existence of the gods. And so they kind of really push sort of the extent, sort of the importance of ritual to its extreme, where it's all about the performance of ritual and not about the world that exists beyond the actual performance of ritual. They argue that the world is eternal, therefore whatever the Veda says about the world being created cannot be interpreted literally, but is actually something that will lead you to perform a ritual, in the sense that they say when the Purusha Sukta describes the world being arising from the sacrifice of the Purusha, they say this is not actually telling you the world emerged from sacrifice because the world is eternal. What the only thing that this is telling you is that you should perform a ritual, you should perform a sacrifice. It's sort of just telling that story to impress upon your mind the importance of sacrifice to then actually perform it, which means that for them, the Veda is a performative text in the sense that it's used in performance, in the performance of ritual, or it's there to get you to perform ritual. It's not a book about knowledge about the nature of reality, as the other schools would see their own texts. But rather, it's a text that is there to get us to perform Vedic ritual, and that's its only function. The Mimamsakas argues the Veda is not there to teach us about this world because we can know the world through sensory perception and through inference and so on. And so we don't need an extra sort of means of understanding the world, because if that was the function of the Veda would be redundant because we already can know the world through other means. And so it's not there to teach us knowledge about anything. It's there to teach us karma, to teach us action, or dharma, as they generally call it. And that is its focus. And as I said, it's like Nyaya, a bit of an academic discipline in the sense that you don't have sort of a religious school of Nyaya. You have a religious school of Mimamsa. The teachers of Mimamsa, unlike the teachers of the other schools, are not venerated as sort of great religious teachers. You won't find Mimamsaka sort of centers of religious practice and so on. But they're very important because what they did was really, after centuries of Buddhist influence in India, it's really the Mimamsakas who kind of bring back the Veda into the discussion. And it's the Mimamsakas who intellectually refute Buddhist ideas and kind of argue, primarily one of the main arguments of Mimamsa is for the validity of Vedic revelation. And it's really kind of in the 8th century or so, 7th, 8th century, that you kind of see a resurgence of Mimamsa. And because you have sort of this resurgence of Mimamsa, you see there's sort of a resurgence of Vedanta then as well. And it's Shankara, who's often sort of credited as sort of the reviver of Hinduism, is really riding on the success of Mimamsa, who's kind of established that already. And he's then sort of building on this and saying, well, we're the Uttara Mimamsa, by the way. We're sort of the later Mimamsa, and we're building on these ideas. And so for that, Mimamsa is immensely important. But as I said, it doesn't kind of develop into a real religious school. It's more kind of a way of thinking about the Veda and thinking about Vedic ritual practice that's very influential and that a lot of ritualists would have followed, but that not all Vedic ritualists would have been Mimamsakas. So anyway, that's sort of rough brush strokes, something about these different schools of thought, as we'll see, particularly Mimamsa, and then especially Vedanta, we'll see more about in next term. We'll see more about Mimamsa as we talk about Vedanta, because they're constantly building on that. But that's kind of the basic idea. But you see, again, if you think about the discussion we started with in the beginning of the term, of the notion of a Hinduism, you see it's very difficult here. These are the earliest schools of what we now call Hinduism, or Hindu thought. And they're all arguing with each other. They have very different metaphysics. They have very different understandings of what the Veda is teaching. Some are theistic, some are atheistic. Some are very much concerned with the interpretation of Vedic texts, some are not. Some argue the self is conscious. Some others, like Nyaya, argue the self is not inherently conscious. It's just a product of the interaction of the self with matter. and some are theistic in the sense that for their understanding of liberation, some like Sankhya are just saying, you know, there is no ultimate, there's no God in the state of liberation. They all kind of argue with each other, and they all refute each other in their own texts and in their own writings. And so we'll see this more as we look at Hinduism too, at sort of the development of the sort of the popular Hindu traditions that we still know today. We'll see this kind of developing further, and we'll see kind of more, particularly here, sort of, you know, distinct schools that develop within some of these schools themselves. So there you go.